CHUM, your station for Beatles celebration. We play all the Beatles on Chum.
20 feet below glide path, a mile and a half from touchdown, on course 25 to the heady. Coming up to the glide path nicely now, just 15 feet low. Go the approach lights now. Coming up nicely now, just 15 feet below glide path. Over the end of the runway, take over and complete your approach.
February 7, 1964, the day the Beatles invaded America. Ringo Starr listened on his transistor radio and shut it off in disbelief. Paul and George glanced out the window and rubbed their eyes just to be sure. John and his wife shuddered. Below them, a few thousand feet beneath the silver belly of Pan Am Flight 101, was a scene of utter pandemonium. So this was America.
Even when we came over to America the first time, we were only coming over to buy LPs.
Oh yeah, I'll tell you something. I think you'll understand. When I say that something, I wanna hold your hand. I wanna hold your hand. I wanna hold your hand. Oh please, say to me,
the Beatles had arrived. No one knew then the enormous dimension of their arrival. Perhaps they were just another hit group, quickly up and dizzyingly forgotten. To many people, the Beatles' reception was merely a craze in which teenagers melted in hysterical rapture at the sight of their heroes, as teenagers of earlier generations had with Frank Sinatra and Elvis Presley. But Beatle fans in their numbers, hysteria, and open love for the group proved that this was not merely a craze. The Beatles were here to stay.
They were just like four boys, and I really liked them. They were good. They were real great guys. It didn't really hit me. And then you see them standing there singing, and I don't know what they do. They just change you. They're not what they used to be. They're just so much better. And you see them on stage, and they look like a myth for you. It's what they seem like. Every little movement's for you and no one else. It seems so personal, but yeah, it's just for everybody.
Did you ever expect the concert to do this to you?
Oh, no. I came here to sing. I'm not going to scream. I'm not going to cry. I'm not going to do anything. So here I am crying. And the thing is, I touched Paul the other day. I thought, well, that's not going to be nothing. I've touched Paul McCartney. And now I've touched him. I can't touch him again, ever again. Never. I got his autograph.
Do you have anything else you want to add?
I just think that oh, the most wonderful person I've ever met in my whole life. I just love him.
She loves you, yeah.
you know you should be glad. With a love like that, you know you should be glad.
Never have they been remembered more than for those three words that characterized an entire age of rock and roll music. This was the start of Beatlemania. It was the last blast before the long period of cool that inevitably came when the audio onslaught became music. And when the swooning girl became a listener.
They give the teenagers something in the way of nonconformity, and I think every teenager, well, that's what they look for. Especially in this day and age, they stress nonconformity, and that's what the Beatles are.
These were the Woolly Years. For the fans and for the Beatles.
When I look back at the Beatle adventure in my career and try to pick out the highlights, it's really quite difficult.
One of our rock research team who toured with the Beatles in the early days has these recollections.
In August and September of 1964, and then again in August of 1965, I had the opportunity to travel with the Beatles as a news correspondent. My reports were aired on 25 radio stations in North America. The statistics are staggering. More than 21 cities in the two tours, 23,000 air miles logged in their chartered aircraft, in and out of hotels, living through high-speed siren-screaming motorcades, and fighting my way through crowds of people, people, and more people. It was San Francisco, August 1964. The air was clear and crisp, and the crowd was thick as the Beatles arrived at the Hilton Hotel. It was my very first look at Beatlemania, and I laughed a little bit at what was happening. It was a trifle ridiculous and a bit superficial. That's what I believed at the time. But later, in those many cities, behind those many police barriers, I was to learn that it was all very real and a phenomenon of the 20th century that would never be repeated. Our first plane flight was from San Francisco to Las Vegas, and it was there that I had my first encounter with the Beatles. They always sat in the rear of the aircraft, and the other groups, other reporters, were funneling back and forth to say hello to the boys, as everyone called them, the boys. I stayed in my seat, preferring instead not to impose myself on them and waiting for a meeting. Throughout everything, I've always dressed in a business suit. There is no other costume for my work. Suddenly, John Lennon, dressed in dungarees and a T-shirt, passed my seat, turned around, and glibly, as only John Lennon can be glib, said to me, "Why are you dressed like such a square?" Well, I answered back quickly and angrily, and I said, "It's a lot better than looking like a slob." He turned around, a bit shocked, and smiled. He turned around again, quite seriously, and said, "What's your name?" Naturally, I told him, and he said, "I'll remember that." He did, and so did the others. But I still wasn't impressed. I was looking for people, real people, and not just for mop-top commercial commodities. And I found them, but it took some time. 3 days later, in Seattle, they invited all the disc jockeys, two of them on board, two British reporters, and yours truly, to their room for interviews. It was a great private interview, and I had a chance to get away from the standard questions about their hair and their girlfriends and what they ate for breakfast. And I talked to John Lennon about the feeling of being poor one day and rich overnight. He told me, and how right he was, that he was much too busy to realize wealth. And I chatted with Ringo and Paul about their views on the United States and Canada, and found out that they were sincerely overwhelmed by their welcome and the crowds that had crashed through the barriers set up in the cities they visited. It was a great interview, and as I walked back to my room, I realized that I had enough material for a few days' reports. But then it happened, the inevitable. It happens to every broadcaster at least once in his life. I played back the recorder, and nothing was recorded. The machine was broken. Quickly, I called their press manager, Derek Taylor. He's still with them, by the way. And he checked with all of them. Now, here was the situation. They were tired after two performances, after two plane flights in one day. No sleep, very little food, and plane fatigue had set in. But 3 minutes later, I received a call from Paul McCartney. He told me to come on up. I did, and we reported and repeated our interview. They didn't have to do that. They didn't even know me that well yet, but they spent about 45 minutes recording an interview that lasted for 30 minutes. Everyone in broadcasting knew they were hard to get, reluctant to be interviewed. but they realized I was in a pinch, and they came through for me. They showed me something then, and from that episode on, I began to see them more as human beings, caught up in an adventure that none of them had ever envisioned, and none of them was able to cope with completely.
Fans swarming the fences at Kennedy on that winter afternoon. 10,000 of the millions who would make the next 3 years the most tempestuous in all pop music history. The Plaza Hotel was an absolute impossibility. For the Beatles, thrill mixed with fear of physical danger. For the hotel, chaos. For the people in the streets, a kind of carnival madness. Reason had flown. Two Ed Sullivan shows were booked for the 9th and 16th of February. There were 728 seats. There were 50,000 requests for tickets. But you could always get a ticket for Carnegie Hall. The promoters had booked two shows. Total price for the Beatles, $6,500. And the time would come when they would be offered a million. Fans who rushed to Carnegie Hall had no more chance of getting in than the Sullivan Show. They could have filled the hall for twice the ticket price. You just couldn't get a ticket, no matter who you were. Even David Niven and Shirley MacLaine were turned away. 73 million people watched the Sullivan Show. 20,000 jammed the Coliseum in Washington. 5 million, the Beatles are coming posters appeared. Billy Graham said they were a passing phase, but even he violated his rule to watch television on the Sabbath just to see them. The New York papers cut them up. All they saw was hair and gyrations and publicity. The message wasn't getting through, only at the cash register. This was the year when the Beatles were never off the charts. They filled the number one spot nationally for 13 weeks, or one quarter of the entire year.
Something to say that might cause you pain. If I catch you talking to that boy again, I'm gonna let you down and leave you flat. to tell you one more time. I think it's just it. I think I let you down.
Let you down.
The night they were on The Sullivan Show, no major crimes were reported committed by teenagers throughout the entire country.
The Beatles first appeared on our show February 9th, 1964, and I've never seen any scenes to compare with the bedlam that was occasioned by their debut on our show. Broadway was just jammed with people for almost eight blocks. It was completely jammed people. They were screaming and yelling. They stopped traffic. It was just indescribable. And on that same bill with them were the youngsters from the Broadway hit of that day, Oliver, comedian Frank Gorshin, Tessie O'Shea. It was just bedlam. There's never been anything like it in show business. And the New York City police are very happy it hasn't and won't happen again.
I just thought it was a joke.
I said, I'm sitting here watching matchbox holding my clothes. I said, I'm sitting here wondering matchbox holding my clothes. I ain't got no matches, but I sure got a long way to go. I'm an old poor boy and I'm a long way from home.
For weeks, the Beatles sold 2.5 million records. The music industry estimated that the Beatles' records accounted for 60% of single sales business during the first 3 months of 64.
Da, 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 da. And the ball is-
It's the swinginest place to be in Toronto.